Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Frank Stacio. Robin Young is on vacation. It's Here and Now. Washington and the legal community are taking the measure of President Bush's nominee for the Supreme Court, John Roberts. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, whose post Roberts is meant to fill, called Roberts a brilliant legal mind, a straight shooter, and, quote, good in every way, except he's not a woman. Well, joining us now is Here and Now's Supreme Court reporter, Lyle Denniston. Thanks for joining us, Lyle.
I'm glad to be with you again.
You have covered the Supreme Court for many years. John Roberts has stood before the Supreme Court as a lawyer, if we have it right, 39 times. Have you had an opportunity to see him in action?
I have indeed, yes. He's a very talented, always well-prepared, and sometimes very clever advocate.
Clever how so?
Well, he knows how to play for votes for individual justices, that is, to shape his argument in order to gain votes from one or more perhaps influential or decisive votes on the court. He's very good at the strategy that's always involved and always required for a solid oral argument, which means to do what the court needs to hear, but to do so in a way that continues to serve the interest of your client.
So as a lawyer, then, he's first rate. But the next question then politically is, has the president sent them someone who the president is sure is a conservative? He's already got this man's opinions on the key issues. Or is this a sign that the president has moved somehow to the middle, sending what appears to be a more moderate conservative for confirmation?
My own perception on that is that the president probably has sought to avoid a confrontation with the Senate by selecting someone whom the president believes will be reliably conservative in the way he behaves on the court, but who will not give serious offense to Democrats and, importantly, not give serious offense to Republican moderates like the senators from Maine and from New England generally. So that I think what the president has done here is to reach out a bit towards the center, though I think he and his advisors are absolutely persuaded that once John Roberts gets on the court, he will be a dependable conservative vote. I'm not sure that you can always predict that, but I think within the realm of reasonable prediction, they're probably right. He will be conservative, and I think the court, as a result, will become more conservative than it has been.
You have said words to the effect that this is the smartest court in history, and we have a man who has impeccable records as a jurist. What do you think his impact on this court would be as the dynamics between and among those nine people play out?
Well, it's always a little bit risky to suggest that when you have eight others who've been serving together for quite a long while, that a new person will arrive and suddenly make an impact. Actually, new persons can do so. I think when Justice Sandra Day O'Connor arrived, her impact was felt almost immediately because she was a very self-confident person. I think John Roberts has the capacity to have some impact at the beginning, but I think the most important thing for us to be watching, at least in the early stages, is whether or not he aligns himself with any one of the blocks within the court. And my own sense about him, just as a person and as a lawyer and as a judge for the past 2 years, is that he probably will be unlikely to align himself, at least immediately, with Justices Scalia and Thomas, who are the court's most conservative members and, of course, the president's favorites among the existing justices, and that he will probably gravitate a little bit toward the new center of the court. But it's important to remember that that new center of the court will be probably considerably right of center.
So do you think he'll actually fill the role, fill the void left by Sandra Day O'Connor?
I think he probably has the capacity to do that in time. He could become a swing vote at the very outset if he starts forming alliances, let's say, with Justices Kennedy and Breyer, who are more moderate than the conservatives on the court, including Chief Justice Rehnquist.
How do you think this confirmation process will go?
Well, I think basically what it'll be is an attempt by the Democrats to smoke out John Roberts, what he believes, indeed maybe even try to force him to say how we would vote, which, of course, he will cleverly avoid doing so. I don't imagine he'll offend them by refusing to answer, because he's clever enough to and smart enough to answer a question without answering it in substantive scope. So I think the Democrats will be attempting to do that. At the same time, the Republicans will be trying to short-circuit the process as much as they can to keep it moving and to stay away from sensitive areas. And I think the activist groups on the left and on the right will be stirring up their membership very energetically, trying to use this as a galvanizing and fundraising tool. But my own sense about it is that the country shouldn't anticipate a really serious inquiry into this, because it fundamentally it's going to be primarily a political show.
Well, Lyle, we will be checking in with you as the show goes on throughout the coming months. Thanks very much.
Fine. Glad to be with you again.
Lyle Dennison is here, NOW's Supreme Court reporter. As we said, the next step in the process for Judge Roberts is confirmation hearings before the Senate Judiciary Committee. One senior member of that committee is Massachusetts Senator Edward Kennedy. He spoke this morning with Here and Now's Dolores Handy.
This announcement was much anticipated. What is your initial reaction to the John Roberts nomination?
Well, I think, first of all, this is a critical moment for this country's future. If John Roberts is confirmed, he'll have a vital role in setting the direction of the country for generations to come. And the Supreme Court, after all, is our last line of defense for freedoms and liberties for hundreds of millions of Americans. And I think a few responsibilities of the Senate are more important. Perhaps going to war is more important, but after that, the votes on the Supreme Court, because it'll be the rulings apply now our children, for our children and our children's generation. Now, I think the overarching issue is whose side is John Roberts going to be on? That's what we want to find out in the course of the hearings.
Just what questions do you want to ask him?
Well, I think every American ought to be asking some tough questions right now, whether Mr. Roberts is fit to serve on the highest court in the land. Will he protect average Americans when their rights are abused by powerful corporations? Will he protect and preserve the progress we've made on equal opportunity and fairness for all Americans? We've come too far in the areas of civil rights. Too many people have sweated. Too many people have died. Too much progress is made to go back. Will he ensure that private companies aren't allowed to pollute our rivers, lakes, and our air? Will he protect a woman's right to choose? Will he protect workers against the corporations that are trying to take away and deny their rights? Will he separate his personal ideology from the rule of law and protect the rights and freedoms of all Americans, not just the powerful or the wealthy? That is what is at stake. We don't know the answers to those questions today, and I think the American people have a right to know whose side is John Roberts going to be on.
During the first Bush administration, Roberts tried to overturn Roe versus Wade. His wife is apparently a member of a group that wants to overturn that decision. Are you concerned that this could be the beginning of the end of Roe versus Wade?
Well, he'll have an opportunity to answer questions on that issue and on other issues as well. He'll be expected to answer. He clearly can't answer a question on a particular case, but he will be inquired of in terms of his understandings of the right to privacy and about the current status of the law. We found with Sandra Day O'Connor, she brought the country together. She respected the Constitution. She was a mainstream conservative that used her ability and respect for the law to find solutions that would strengthen the nation as the Constitution intended. And I think Mr. Roberts has to demonstrate that he meets that standard before the American people. And he'll have the opportunity to do so before the Senate Judiciary Committee in the coming weeks. And I'm looking forward to that opportunity.
Do you think it will be a contentious process?
Well, it doesn't have to be. But I think we have a responsibility under the Constitution to do what we need to do in order to get responses to that, and we have every expectation of doing so.
Senator Kennedy, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy speaking with Here and Now's Dolores Handy. For more analysis, we turn to Professor Susan Lowe Block, who teaches at Georgetown University Law School. She joins us on the line from Nice, France. Welcome, Professor Block.
Nice to be with you.
What a time to go on vacation. You're missing all the fun.
I know. It's nice to be able to talk to you and feel like I have some contact with you.
You're part of it all. Listen, the basic question, I guess, is why John Roberts now?
I think what Bush was trying to do is to find a relatively non-controversial conservative nominee. Roberts had just gotten through the Senate very easily, I guess, 2 or 3 years ago. And I think Bush probably personally liked him. He's a very likable person.
Yeah, and his credentials as a jurist seem impeccable.
His credentials are, yes, absolutely impeccable. I mean, you can't want someone better qualified in the sense of the right degrees and the right experiences.
Right. So the question politically, I guess, is, and the question that we're hearing from some liberal circles is he a Trojan horse? Is this one who seems to be moderate, but in fact he may turn out to be very far to the right?
Well, I think the problem with him is simply that we don't have a large track record of him as a judge. We have a huge, wonderful track record of him as a student and as a law clerk and as an incredible Supreme Court advocate. But in none of those is he really indicating what his personal views are.
There is a bit of a record, anyway, on certainly one of the most controversial issues. There is some very small record on Roe v. Wade.
Not as a judge, though, as an advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Working for a Republican administration that wants to overturn Roe, he will write and say what his client wants him to say. I'm not quite sure it tells us anything about how he would rule as Supreme Court justice.
And tell us a little bit about that process. I mean, the fact is that it is something that I suspect critics may want to latch on to, that is, what he's done as an attorney or as an advocate. But as you suggest, that's not always a good way to get at what someone might do as a judge.
Yeah, I think you cannot tell very much from the positions he took as an advocate, because as an advocate, he is paid to advocate what his client wants. You can assume, I guess, he's not too uncomfortable with the position, because at some point, as an advocate, you might decline. But I don't see any of his positions indicating that those are his personal views. The other thing about him is he is young. He's only 50. And I think it's difficult to know how he will mature. He could get more conservative. He could get less conservative. He could be like a Justice Blackmun, who went from being very conservative to being on the far left of the court. And when you put someone in that young, and he's smart and thoughtful, it's difficult to predict.
We are talking about President Bush's nomination of John Roberts to replace Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court. My guest is Professor Susan Block of Georgetown University Law School, and we will return to this conversation when our program continues. It's Here and Now. Stay with us. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Here and Now. We are talking with Professor Susan Lowe Block. She teaches law at Georgetown University. And just before the break, we were talking about how the Senate and the Senate Judiciary Committee can divine what they're going to get if John Roberts becomes an associate justice on the Supreme Court. And I suppose one of the things that's important to understand, Professor Block, is that presidents think they know what they're going to get when they nominate a justice. But once that judge gets on the bench, I guess things can turn out quite differently.
That's correct. I mean, there's some notable examples of justices who turn out far different from the prediction that the president nominating them would have thought. Two classic examples named by Eisenhower are Justices Warren and Justice Brennan. Both were put on by a Republican, Eisenhower, and both turned out to be among the more liberal justices ever on the court. And Eisenhower, in fact, said they were his two biggest mistakes.
Hmm.
Another example is Blackmun, who was put on by Nixon as a conservative and over the years moved very far to the left. A lifetime appointment, especially when you start at the age of 50.
Yeah.
It's difficult to know how they'll develop.
Well, particularly, I would think if you have a lot of confidence in yourself as a jurist, if you know, and apparently Judge Roberts knows how to argue and knows his way around a courtroom, is that any indicator of how much independence and how much a candidate might drift once they get the job?
Well, I think you've got it right when you say someone with confidence is someone that probably can move more easily than someone who's terrified by the job. I think once he gets on the Supreme Court, assuming he does, he'll have a lot of really smart people talking to him, colleagues. He'll have Justices Ginsburg and Breyer on the left talking to him. He'll have Justice Scalia on the right. And these are really brilliant minds, and he'll listen. Who he'll find most persuasive is hard to predict, but he's going to be in the company of really brilliant people.
Yeah, and I wonder to what extent the makeup of the court that an individual finds themselves on plays a part in their sort of changing positions over time.
I think the composition of the court is hugely important. Some of Justice Kennedy's movement somewhat to the left was influenced by the arrival of Justice Souter, for example. Mm. I think Justice Blackmun was very influenced over the years by Justice Brennan and maybe Justice Marshall. They spend a lot of time with the other eight justices, and if they're smart and they're open-minded, then a judge like Judge Roberts, who's young, confident, and smart, is going to learn from these older, wise people. How he's going to move is hard to predict, but I think he'll move.
He'll move somehow. You know, a lot of folks, in talking about the danger and the peril of trying to predict, the smart money said that President Bush would nominate a woman for this job, and he didn't. Why not, do you think? What happened?
First of all, he is anticipating having a Rehnquist slot in the next year or two, and I think that's a pretty safe bet. So my guess is when he picked Roberts, he also has in mind exactly how he's going to fill the next slot as well. I don't think he thought of this as a sole slot. I think he probably thought of it as, you know, at least two. Obviously, Ruth Ginsburg's on there, so, I mean, it's not going to be womanless. On the other hand, I personally imagine he just really was taken by John Roberts. He is a very impressive, very likable person.
From all we can tell at this point, this may not be the most controversial nomination in recent years, but over the past few years and over the past couple of decades, we've seen Supreme Court fights become among the most contentious in American politics. Has it always been that way?
No, not all the time. I mean, we can remember Judges Bork and Judge Thomas being incredibly contentious and ugly. Prior to that, they were less contentious. But over the 200 years, there have been other contentious battles. I think it's become more prominent, and we notice it more now because so much is televised and because we have 24/7 news coverage. It wasn't always televised. The nominees didn't always testify. As we get more cameras in there, and as the Supreme Court has become more involved in our daily lives, like with desegregation and affirmative action and abortion, people are paying more attention.
Well, I wonder how much of that is the politics, our politics and the process, and how much of it is the nature of the court and the way its role has changed over time.
All of those factors are just incredibly important in making this such a high-profile event. I think it was better when it was less high-profile. I'm not sure that we're better off this way.
Well, I guess that's the follow-up is, has the court become too politicized? Was it meant to be something outside the fray, and has it become far too political?
It's not that the court has become too political. It's that some of the issues that are reaching the court are such hot-button issues that it has of necessity become political, whether that's a good thing or not, I'm not sure. I preferred it in the old days, but I'm not sure there's any going back at this point.
Susan Lowe Block is a professor of law at Georgetown University. She spoke with us while on vacation from Nice, France. Susan, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Well, abortion is quickly surfacing as a point of contention in Roberts' nomination. The group NARAL Pro-Choice America announced its opposition to Judge Roberts even before the president made his selection public last night. That group is planning an emergency demonstration against Roberts today on Capitol Hill. In the meantime, a group called Progress for America pledged in advance of yesterday's news that it will spend at least $18 million on television ads and grassroots efforts to support anyone the president nominates for the high court. As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email and at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your name and the town you're from. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Frank Stasio, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Bush's nomination of John Roberts as the next Supreme Court justice will give the White House press secretary a bit of breathing room. Spokesperson Scott McClellan's been taking his lumps for the past couple of weeks as reporters have hit him with an unending barrage of questions about the role of the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, Karl Rove, in outing an undercover CIA agent. Rove has been identified as the source by two reporters on their stories that named Valerie Plame as a CIA operative. This after the president and McClellan had previously denied that Rove was involved. Well, that can put a spokesperson in a tough spot, and we wanted to check in to see how Scott McClellan has fared, so we decided to call T.J. Walker. He's the president of Media Training Worldwide. TJ has trained thousands of politicians and corporate leaders to deal with situations just like the one McClellan is facing now. TJ is currently conducting a media workshop in Milan, Italy, and joins us on the line. TJ, welcome.
Hi, Frank.
So listen, Scott McClellan is in a tough spot. Reporters are coming close to calling him a liar. I think they've gone beyond that, in fact, because McClellan had previously said Karl Rove was not involved. Oh, he was. And now Karl Rove, now that we know that he was involved, what advice do you give a guy like Scott McClellan?
Well, first of all, he should look at old videos of his predecessor, Ari Fleischer. Part of the beauty of his predecessor is he never looked embarrassed about it. He never looked like he saw the contradiction in his own mind. That's part of McClellan's problem, is you can tell he's realizing, uh-oh, these reporters have nailed me. With Fleischer, you never got the sense that he saw any contradiction whatsoever. And I don't say that to condemn him. I think that he was an effective spokesperson for President Bush. He was exactly what Bush wanted. It's a very difficult position because most people have a hard time saying with a straight face that black is white and white is black. Now, I'm not accusing Scott McClellan of having to lie or anyone else any more than any other government press secretary.
Right.
But you're put in a difficult position sometimes.
Yeah, but let me ask you that. Is this genetic? I mean, is there a shame gene that maybe Ari Fleischer is missing that Scott McClellan has? I mean, can you really teach this?
Well, you can help someone get a lot better. And it's not that you can't have any shame. It's just you have to realize your role in the process. If you are a spokesperson, you have to realize it's not your job to paint a fair and balanced picture of reality. That's the journalist's job. That's NPR's job.
As we've said, Scott McClellan has had his problems. Here's a clip from July 11th. Let's listen.
I mean, this is ridiculous. The notion that you're going to stand before us after having commented with that level of detail and tell people watching this that somehow you've decided not to talk, you've got a public record out there. Do you stand by your remarks from that podium or not?
And again, David, I'm well aware, like you, of what was previously said, and I will be glad to talk about it at the appropriate time. The appropriate time is when the investigation...
Why are you choosing when it's appropriate, when it's inappropriate?
If you'll let me finish.
No, you're not finishing. You're not saying anything.
Okay. What should Scott McClellan have done?
Let's first of all recognize that he is in a difficult situation and that there's only one answer that's going to please reporters. What the reporter wants to hear is, you're right. I am caught with my pants down. We said one thing last year, and now if we had any intellectual consistency, we'd fire Karl Rove and apologize to the American people. But he's not going to say that. He can't say that. But he made a mistake by saying, I'm well aware of what I said in the past. There's no value in saying that. He'd be better off by starting with the second part of his comment, which is, there's an investigation going on right now. I'll be happy to give comment at conclusion of the investigation, and doing it with a smile on his face, and doing it, the thing that his predecessor did was so good, he would say it without a trace of annoyance. He would say it without a trace of embarrassment, and that's part of the problem with McClellan that unfortunately, we need the television to realize is he's saying it with a little bit of embarrassment on his face. It's very important that you get not only the words right, but the facial expressions right, the tone of voice right. Everything has to be in sync to exude the exact positive message you're trying to communicate.
So let's do a little experiment here then, TJ. We're going to play a question for you, and then we're going to hold off and see what you would advise Scott McClellan to do. This is ABC News reporter Terry Moran going at it with McClellan. Let's listen.
Go ahead, Terry.
You're in a bad spot here, Scott, because after the investigation began, after the criminal investigation was underway, you said, October 10th, 2003, I spoke with those individuals, Rove, Abrams, and Libby. As I pointed out, those individuals assured me they were not involved in this. From that podium, that's after the criminal investigation began. Now that Rove has essentially been caught red-handed, peddling this information, all of a sudden you have respect for the sanctity of the criminal investigation?
All right, there it is. Now, what do you do? We're in training now. Scott McClellan's right in front of you. What do you say?
There's no one perfect answer in media training for all crises, but something along the lines of, we're all learning new information every day. As soon as we get conclusive information from the investigation, I'll be happy to deliver that to you.
All right, well, let's hear how Scott actually answered that question.
No, that's not a correct characterization, Terry, and I think you are well aware of that. We know each other very well, and it was after that period that the investigators had requested that we not get into commenting on an ongoing criminal investigation. And we want to be helpful so that they can get to the bottom of this, because no one wants to get to the bottom of more than President of the United States.
How would you rate that?
Awful in every regard. Number one, he sounds whiny. He sounds like he's being a crybaby. He's saying, you know, that's not correct. He's quibbling with the premises of the reporter. And that's just, once you start down that road, it's a losing battle. We know each other really well. It's sort of like saying, well, you know, you're my friend. Why are you picking on me? He sounds defensive. He sounds peevish. I think the only thing he can say at this point is there is an investigation. Once conclusive information comes from that investigation, I'll be happy to give you our perspective on it. And to act like there's nothing he'd rather be talking about than that. Because when reporters sense that you're hating this, that this is torture, that makes it more fun as a reporter. Believe me, the reporters at the White House, they're having a field day. This is Christmas for them.
I really want to get you to comment on this one, because this is veteran White House reporter Helen Thomas. Helen Thomas is 84 years old, God bless her. She's covered the White House for nearly 60 years. She's known to be a thorn in the side of every press secretary. Let's listen to her question, and then you tell me how you would advise Scott McClellan.
Go ahead.
His problem. 2 years, and he can't call Rove in and find out what the hell's going on.
Yeah, Helen,
why is it so difficult to find out the facts? It costs thousands, millions of dollars, 2 years, tied up how many lawyers? All he's got to do is call him in.
All right. Now, I know you say you don't want to give too much advice going in, but clearly there's a way to manage this kind of a question.
Just say, Helen, thank you for the question. I want you to know that the president fully respects the investigation process. He's going to wait until all facts become known.
TJ Walker, president of Media Training Worldwide, spoke with us on the phone from Milan, Italy. Thank you, TJ.
Thank you, Frank.
Still to come, new CD tributes to Bobby Darin, Ray Charles, and George Gershwin. James Isaacs joins us. You're listening to Here and Now. With summer here, folks are always looking around for a new place to swim. And here in Boston, some are looking no further than the Charles River.
You guys rock!
You know what I like about Boston? Winning the World Series.
Used to be among the most polluted waterways in the country, featured in the song Dirty Water. This version is a cover by Red Sox ace pitcher Bronson Arroyo. But now, according to the Charles River Watershed Association, water in parts of the Charles is actually safe for swimming. We took a trip down to the banks of the River Charles to see if anyone was in the water.
Yeah, down by the river. Down by the banks of the River Charles.
If it's clean, yeah. Why not?
Not voluntarily.
Perhaps. It looks pretty clean, but you never know what's inside of the river.
I hear that you had a little spill and you ended up in the river involuntarily.
That's right. It was a hot day. It felt good. The water was brown and didn't look too clean, but I wasn't too worried about it.
Not for fun, no. You can look, and there's still large pieces of garbage. You can see the bottle right there floating through the river, and it's pretty dirty, so I would never go in.
Probably not. I grew up with it being so dirty all these years that it's kind of hard to change your opinion of it.
While that Bostonian isn't about to jump into the Charles, Renata von Charner already has. She's president of the Charles River Conservancy, and she joins us on the line. Renata, welcome.
Hello.
Tell us what briefly about the history of swimming in the Charles. It used to be a fun spot and lots of beaches, right?
Well, it was. There were beaches until 1955, but it was not because the water was clean. It's just that because people did not know that the water was so dirty. It is now really only that the river has been cleaned and swimmable since probably the last 300 years.
So folks were swimming in it. They didn't realize how polluted it was. And what kind of pollutants are in the Charles?
Well, it's a long list of chemicals, but it was at the Charles that the American Industrial Revolution really started. And then there was also raw sewage. There was storm water, which is still a problem. But the pollution has been going way back. But now we are in a whole new time and the water is clean.
It really is safe, you're saying?
It is.
Well, why is that? Has it just flushed itself out?
No, there have been millions spent. And organizations, they all have worked to clean it up. And this joint effort now resulted that the water is clean, but there are other problems still.
The sediment is still a problem, isn't it?
That's correct, yes.
So now what would you do about it? Because you don't want to come in contact with the bottom.
No, so that is the challenge, the technological challenge. How can you swim and not stir up the sediment, not touch the sediment? So that is the next phase and to make swimming possible, to make safe public swimming possible.
What are some of the ways that people could have access to the water and not come in contact with that?
There are, of course, you can swim off a deck, so not touch the base. There is a way maybe dredging the sediment and replacing it with clean sand. There are models of swimming, floating bathhouses.
You can get some of those really big floaties and never touch the bottom, I guess.
That's right.
There you go.
There have been experiments by the EPA to have what's called a gunaboom, which is a big nylon sock-like pool. That you suspend in the water. Mm. So that is the challenge that we hope to address with MIT to look at how that can be solved.
Are there any other urban rivers that have gone through similar cleanups?
In terms of this country, I think the Charles is probably the most advanced in both cleaning its water and looking at swimming. In Europe, there are many rivers, and just this Sunday when we jumped into the Charles, there were 200 events in 10 countries on 30 rivers that had events called the Big Jump. So this is a big movement in Europe, and that's where I'm from. I'm from Switzerland. I used to swim in rivers all the time.
All right, that's good enough for me. Hold my jacket. I'm going in.
Great.
Okay, we've been speaking with Renata von Charner of the Charles River Conservancy. Renata, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, I love that dirty water. Oh, Boston, you're my home.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
I don't know how it works like that, but that's how we do it.
That's right.
Well, I love that dirty water.
I'm Frank Stacio. It's Here and Now. And James Isaacs, our very own jazz aficionado, joins us now with three new tribute CDs to recommend, plus a surprise featuring one of today's most prolific and popular singer-songwriters, who, by the way, happens to perform with one of NPR's leading jazz personalities. Hello, James.
How are you doing, Frank?
I'm fine. Today, now, we're going to talk about tribute discs. The idea of the tribute album really has caught on during the past 10 or 15 years. Why is that?
Well, Frank, I think that in the world of jazz, the tribute album has grown increasingly popular because we've lost so many masters of jazz style, and especially of jazz substance, and there aren't nearly as many enduring songs, the classic pop idiom that was being written in the 1920s and 30s and 1940s and 50s. Also, I think it's another way to connect with an audience that's familiar with both the recipient of the tribute and the songs themselves.
Oh, yeah.
So you're a winner three times with the tribute format if it's done well.
Exactly. Well, where do you want to start?
I think I'd like to start with the saxophonist and flutist David Newman, who is somewhat unfortunately known as Fathead. His new tribute album is to his longtime employer and friend Ray Charles, and it's just been released.
How long was David Newman in Ray's band?
From 1954 to 1964, and he was a featured soloist for much of that time. And on this superb and soulful new album called I Remember Brother Ray, David Newman plays tenor saxophone only. The tune I've selected here is a favorite standard ballad of mine. When I say favorite standard ballad, as done by Ray Charles, I love the way he did the song Ruby, which was a movie song written for a 1952 film called Ruby Gentry. You ever see it?
I did not.
I never even heard of it.
I did not. No.
But anyway, it's a beautiful song. Wow. Now it's David Newman who is the sole singer, and his highly melodic approach to the tenor saxophone suggests that of the great Ben Webster. David Newman from I Remember Brother Ray, Ruby.
Okay, so now what is our next tribute?
Well, Frank, it's to a guy who's not generally associated with jazz, but the musician paying tribute to this artist is among the finest, although at age 65, he's still among the most underrated jazz pianists, and I am speaking of Roger Kellaway. For 2.5 years back in the 1960s, Roger Kellaway served as the pianist, arranger, and musical director for Bobby Darin.
Bobby Darin, and like Ray Charles, Bobby Darin also the subject of a movie that came out last year.
Yeah, that's true. And when Kevin Spacey, who played Bobby Darin in the movie Beyond the Sea, took a band on the road late in 2004 to help promote this movie, he called on Roger Kellaway to be his pianist, arranger, and musical director. And this new Roger Kellaway Trio CD called Remembering Bobby Darin is additionally interesting because it not only honors the memory of Darin via some of his signature songs, but it's also a companion piece to a solo piano tribute to Darin by Kellaway that was released earlier this year. Now, I think that most of our listeners will recognize this particular tune, but for those who don't, it's Mack the Knife, which was, of course, Bobby Darin's greatest hit. Frank, I also wanted to mention another aspect of this album because in addition to being a tribute to Bobby Darin, it's a tribute to the Oscar Peterson trio that the great pianist Oscar Peterson led in the early to mid-1950s, the one without the drummer, the piano, guitar, and bass trio. And they swing, and the interactive musical dialogues that take place here in the Roger Kellaway album very much recall the great Oscar Peterson trio of that time.
And that really is some of the charm of these tribute CDs, is the ability to take a song that we're very familiar with and a style that we're very familiar with and then recast it and bring some, you know, some other creative energy to it.
Well, as I say, this guy, Roger Kellaway, is such a wonderful pianist. More people should know his name.
Yeah.
And he is absolutely fearless. He is so eclectic, but not in a corny way. You know, he can play in virtually any style from stride to avant-garde. And you hear many of his musical proclivities on this tribute to Bobby Darin. So interesting and highly rated stuff.
It's great. It's great. Okay. So now before we get to the third and final tribute CD, the suspense is killing me. You've got a surprise.
I do indeed.
All right, let's hear it.
What is it? Petite surprise. Okay. The surprise is, well, let me preface the surprise with this little remark. I don't think that most jazz fans think of Elvis Costello, there's the surprise, when the talk turns to jazz singing. But in the year 2003, Elvis was the guest of Marion McPartland on her long-running NPR program Piano Jazz, and that particular show has just been issued on the Jazz Alliance label. Additionally, Elvis Costello has another connection to jazz. He's married to the very popular singing-songwriting pianist Diana Krall. They've written songs together, Elvis and Diana Krall, in fact. So this is the latest in a series of piano jazz broadcasts that the label has released. But what I thought we'd do is listen first to Elvis Costello and Marion McPartland chat a bit. And as you'll hear, Elvis does not lack a sense of humor when it comes to his vocals and sensibility in general. And then they'll perform part of what Elvis calls a blue ballad. It's the standard tune, You Don't Know What Love Is. Elvis Costello talking and then playing with Marion McPartland.
You Don't Know What Love Is that the song we were talking about doing?
Yes.
It's not really a dark song, but it's sort of semi-dark.
I can make it dark. I can make On the Sunny Side of the Street sound dark. I've had this face for 48 years now. There's nothing I can do about it.
Oh, you're just a kid. Well, let's do that, because that's one of my favorite tunes. I'd love to hear you sing
that. That'd be great.
You don't know what love is until you've learned the meaning of the blues. Until you've lost a love you've had to lose. You don't know.
It's quite a vibrato he sings with, huh?
Yeah. It really is kind of surprising to hear him move into that mode. It is not what you
would expect.
Well,
he's recorded a bunch of standards, not on one single album, but sprinkled over the, it seems like, 75 albums that he's recorded during the last 30 years. He's recorded about a dozen standards.
Well, this should come as no surprise. George Gershwin, and I see that that's what you have last on the list here.
One last but hardly least.
No, one of the foremost composers, of course. And he also is on a tribute CD.
He is the recipient of a most eloquent tribute by the young pianist Bill Charlap, who is not only one of today's most inventive young pianists, but he has a tremendous sense of musical tradition in every way. This is the first time Charlap has ever had a horn section, although they don't appear on every selection, on Bill Charlap Plays George Gershwin, The American Soul. Charlap also arranged the material, and he gives it a nicely modern touch without taking it to the outer limits. Okay, Bill Charlap and friends, their take on the Gershwin tune called Somebody Loves Me.
Somebody Loves Me. Bill Charlap plays George Gershwin. The American Soul is the name of that tribute CD. And we found out about it because of Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs. For more information on all the new music he brought to our attention today, you can check out our website, here-now.org. James, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Frank.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Frank Stacio. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.